My parents were not big on restaurants. Part of the problem was the selection in our small town. We had a Dairy Queen that offered the finest gourmet selection, and everything else went downhill from there. Other reason was practicality. Why eat out when we have plenty of food right here at home? So restaurant trips were maybe once a month, Sunday only events. Funny, when we're raising our daughters, instead of thinking, why eat out when you can eat in, we decided, why eat in when you can go out? We would tell our daughters it's time for dinner, and they would all head to the garage. But when I was growing up, we typically ate at home, and every time we ate at home, my mom gave my brother and me the same instructions. Eat a little bit of everything. Volume was never the issue. My brother and I were big eaters. We didn't have to be told to clean the plate, but variety was a problem. Mom was a good cook, but she had some of these dishes that boiled okra, asparagus, more like crocra, gasparagus. I'm not sure they were intended for human consumption, but according to Mom, they were, and according to Mom, they had to be eaten, just sampled. You don't have to eat everything, but just eat a little bit of everything. That was the rule in our house. But that was not the rule at the cafeteria. Do you like going to cafeterias for meals? I love them. I think we're losing them, but we're loving them. And I loved going to the cafeteria. There was one about 45 minutes away from our small West Texas town. I came to see that cafeteria, it was called Furs, that cafeteria was the greatest culinary invention since the gas stove. What a joy, what a joy to stand and take a tray and gaze down that midway at all the endless options, a veritable cornucopia. I was impressed with that. Fine cuisine. Down the row you walk. Intoxicated with all the options and selection. Liberated by the freedom. You don't take a little bit of everything. Instead, you take only what you want. Yes to the fried chicken. No to the fried tomatoes. Yes to the pecan pie. And no, no, 1,000 times no to the crocra and the gasparagus. Cafeteria lines. That's how we're going to eat in heaven. It's one big cafeteria line. Wouldn't it be nice if love were like a cafeteria line? What if you could look at the person with whom you live and select what you want and discard what you don't? Wouldn't that be great? What if parents could do this with kids? I'll have a plate of good grades and cute smiles, but no, I'm passing on that teenage identity crisis and those tuition bills. What if kids could do the same with parents? Oh, please give me a heavy helping of allowances, free lodging, but no discipline, no curfews. Thank you. And spouses. I'll have a bowl of good health and good moods. But job transfers, cranky attitudes, laziness, in-laws, no thanks. Wouldn't it be great if love were like a cafeteria line? It would be painless. It would be pleasant. But you know what it wouldn't be? It wouldn't be love. Because love doesn't just accept a few things. Love is willing to accept all things. Don't like that idea? Well, take it up with the Apostle Paul. Because he said love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Can we read that verse out loud together, please? Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. 1 Corinthians 13:7. So the apostle is wanting to wrap a ribbon around what has been an eloquent and elegant chapter. I envision the leathery-faced apostle signaling for his scribe to hold off while he thinks, have I covered everything? And he begins to list everything he's mentioned. Well, we've talked about patience and kindness and envy. We talked about rudeness and selfishness. We covered anger and forgiveness and evil and truth. But have I covered all things? Ah, there it is. All things. Here, write this. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Paul was never more the poet than when he crafted this sentence. Listen to how the original listeners heard this. You know the New Testament written in Greek. They would have heard it like this. Panta stege, panta pistue, panta elpige, panta upomene. What y'all do at church today? Oh, we studied Greek. Panta, 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 panta. All things, all things, all things, all things. That Greek word has influenced our English dictionary. Pantheism, panta, pantheism, is the belief that God is all things. You may have a pantry, in your kitchen where hopefully you collect all things. A panacea is a cure for all things. A panoply is an array of all things. Panta means all things. God's love, God's view of love was like my mother's view of food. You got to take what you get. When we love someone, we take the entire package. No picking and choosing. No helpings of the good and passing on the bad. Love is a package deal. But how can we do this? I mean, some people are just so hard to love. How can we love those who are difficult to love? Well, the Apostle Paul was facing the same question. In fact, did you know the reason that we have this epistle that's called 1 Corinthians is because Paul wrote it to Christians who lived in southern Greece in Corinth, and the church had begun to go wacko. There were problems on every pew. It was a mess. In fact, if we zoom out and take a look at the big issues in the letter Paul wrote to the Corinthian church, we realized that the church was in trouble. They were out of step with each other. There was no unity. Paul had barely begun dictating this epistle when we read in chapter 1, verses 10 through 11, I appeal to you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree and there be no dissensions among you, but that you be united in the same mind, in the same judgment. For it has been reported to me by Chloe's people that there is quarreling among you. And this word quarreling literally means warring or battling. They're breaking out in fights. They're having arguments, not just different opinions, but they're having trouble coming to the same table. The Corinthian congregation was at war. Why? Because they couldn't agree on a leader. Paul says, one of you says, I follow Paul. Another says, I follow Apollos. Another says, I follow Peter. And another says, I follow Christ. And another says, I follow Biden. And another says, I follow Trump. I just added that myself. They couldn't agree on a leader. You would think they could, it would be so easy. It's Jesus. It's Jesus. But somehow things had got all messed up in their mind, and they said, well, I'm going to follow that great preacher by the name of Apollos. Another one said, no, it's Peter. No, it's Paul. Somebody else followed. Well, isn't Jesus? You would think they could agree that the head of the church was Jesus, but they couldn't. When it came to unity, the members were out of step. When it came to morals, oh my goodness, these Christians in Corinth were out of control. We won't dig into it too much, but Paul does say, I can hardly believe the report about the sexual immorality going on among you. You should be mourning in sorrow and shame. Now, Paul doesn't know what's worse, the activity or of the church, or the apathy of the church regarding the activity. And then there was another issue, and that is theology. The church was arguing over something that will sound odd to our ears, but it was, can we eat meat that's been offered to idols? I mean, it's still good meat. You see, Corinth, a pagan city, was populated by temples where animals would be sacrificed and the meat would be placed, and something has to be done with that meat. The Christians were saying, well, now that I'm a Christian, I can go eat that meat. No need to throw it out. And some of the others were saying, oh, no, you can't do that. That's been offered to idols. It was a big issue. So Paul agreed with those who said, it's okay if you do. He said, we don't lose anything if we don't eat it. We don't gain anything if we do. In other words, it's not a big deal. But what was a big deal was the arrogance around the pro-eaters. They were really proud of themselves for being liberated. It's hard to miss the sarcasm of the next verse, verse 2. Yes, we know that we all have knowledge about this issue. But while knowledge makes us feel important, it is love that strengthens the church. Anyone who claims to know all the answers doesn't really know very much. In other words, if you're a know-it-all, we're not very impressed with you. So all that to say, the Corinthian church was a mess. Regarding unity, they were out of step. Regarding morality, they were out of control. Theologically, they were out of line. So how do you help a church like that? Well, you can correct them. You can instruct them. You can reason with them. Paul does all of that in this epistle. But at some point, you know what you do? You stop talking to the head and you start talking to the heart. And that's what Paul does in 1 Corinthians 13, the whole chapter. And the climax is 13:7. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. You parents can relate to the problem or the dilemma facing the Apostle Paul, right? You've had your kids argue and squabble. You hear a blood-curdling cry come out of your six-year-old's bedroom. You run up there, and she's crying, and there your eight-year-old son is standing. And she says, he threw my baby don't potty out the window. And she says, yeah, but she took my football and threw it up on the roof. Back and forth they go. She did, he did, he did, she did, he did, he did. Back and forth. Finally, you just say, hold it. You make a timeout with your hands. And you have them sit down. And you talk to them about something far greater than toys and balls. You talk to them about love, about family, about loyalty, how we're all in this together, how we need one another. You do your very best to go deeper with them. In fact, you're pretty impressed that you can wax eloquent on this subject. Then you stand and leave. Now, they could break out fighting at any moment, but at least you've tried to deposit these seeds. This is what Paul is doing. For 12 chapters, he's wrestled to untie all these knots of disunity. In fact, picking up on chapter 14, he'll try it again, dealing with the controversy about the Holy Spirit. But chapter 13 is time out. Time out. Can we talk about something higher than squabbles? Can we talk about, and here's his word, A-G-A-P-E, love, love. That's the word that repeats itself over and over in 1 Corinthians 13. It's more than just friendship, more than just hospitality, more than just kindness. This is divine love. The very word used in the most famous verse in the Bible. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. For God so agapeo his son, the world that he gave his one and only son. It's a sacrificial love. It's a love that puts the needs of someone else above the needs of oneself. It's a divine love. And in the end, that is what holds people together. Is love. Boy, don't we need a prescription of love today? Some of you are battling emotions. Some of you are battling anger. Some of you are struggling with thoughts, maybe relationships. Maybe it is absolutely impossible to put up with that person with whom you live anymore. God's word for you is love. Agape. Love. It's not easy. Do you know it wasn't easy for Jesus? Here's a verse that you might not know is in the Bible. Here's something Jesus said. You might can hardly imagine he said, but it's in Mark chapter 9 and verse 19. You people have no faith. How long must I stay with you? How long must I put up with you? Even the Son of God was handed a plate of crocra and gasparagus. He looked at the people and said, don't you get it? Don't you have any faith? How long must I put up with you? And as you read the story of his life, you read his answer. Long enough to be called crazy by my brothers and liar by my neighbors. Long enough to be run out of my town and my temple. Long enough to be laughed at, cursed, slapped, hit, blindfolded, and mocked. Long enough to feel warm spit and sharp whips and see my own blood puddle at my feet. How long? Until the rooster sings and the sweat stings and the mallet rings and a hillside of demons smirk at a dying God. How long? Long enough for every sin to so soak my sinless soul that heaven will turn in horror until my swollen lips pronounce the final transaction. How long? Until it kills me. Jesus bore all things, believed all things, hoped all things. He endured all things, every single one. May I close by urging us to do the same. Anyone who ever would suggest that Jesus didn't have a sense of humor never read these words from the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 7, why do you notice the little piece of dust in your friend's eye? But you don't notice the big piece of wood in your own eye? How can you say to your friend, let me take that little piece of dust out of your eye? Look at yourself. You still have that big piece of wood in your own eye. You hypocrite. First, take the wood out of your own eye. Then you will see clearly to take the dust out of your friend's eye. And Jesus envisioned a fellow who's walking around with a 2x4 sticking out of his eye. It protrudes like Pinocchio's nose. Every time he turns around, everybody has to duck for cover for fear of getting knocked over. He can't play a round of golf because if he looks down, the stick hits the ground. And even though the beam is in his eye, it's never on his mind. He's naive regarding the stares of others. Everybody's looking at him. He thinks they like his shirt. He never notices his beam, the stick sticking out of his eye, but he cannot help but notice that fella across the street, down the block, who is dabbing his eye with a tissue because there's a tiny, tiny, tiny little piece of dust that's in his eye. All full of self-righteousness. The fella says, well, I better go help him. And he looks to the right and he looks to the left, knocking people over, and he runs across the street and then down the street, and he walks up to the guy who has just that speck of dust in the corner of his eye, and he says, hey, buddy, you ought to be more careful. Don't you know that if you get something in your eye, it can be harmful? And then he turns smugly and walks away. That's bizarre, isn't it? But the point from our master is, we tend to have eagle eye vision when it comes to the faults and weaknesses of others. And we can be blind as a mole when it comes to ourselves. Don't we excel in finding faults with others? Yet, shouldn't we begin with the person in the mirror? You think the world needs a little more tolerance? Then be tolerant. You wish people would quit complaining so much? When you quit, the world will have one less complainer. You think nobody gives a hoot about the poor? Well, the hoot level will increase with your compassion. If you want to change the world, start with the person in the mirror. Before you point out the specks in the eyes of others, make sure that you're not sporting a sequoia limb. Jesus' teaching does not preclude helping others, constructive criticism or advice. He simply said, get the sequence right. First, take the wood out of your eye. Then you will see clearly to take the dust out of your friend's eye. Yeah, there is a time to speak up, but first check your motives. Never bring someone down so that you can go up. And rather than put them in their place, put yourself in their place. Several years ago, our friend who speaks here quite regularly, Rick Atchley, and his wife, Jamie, celebrated at that time their 30th anniversary. And I called and congratulated him, and I said, Rick, what's the secret to 30 years of a healthy and happy marriage? He said, well, early on, my wife suggested an arrangement. She would make all the small decisions, and then she would come to me for all the major ones. Wouldn't you know, all these years have passed. We have yet to have a major decision. Well, that's facetious for sure, but there's wisdom in acknowledging the relatively small number of major decisions in life. And yet most of our trouble comes because we get tangled up in the small stuff. But you know, if you don't sweat the small stuff, you won't sweat much. Because it's all small. Well, over the next few days, your love will be tested. She's going to take up her half of the garage right in the middle. He's going to snore like a foghorn.